Good day. Today is Wednesday, 29th April 2026, and before I proceed with this programme, let me just first of all thank everybody for their very kind, very supportive, very generous words sent to me over the last 24 hours in connection with my recent illness. My wife and I have been deeply moved by your words of support and your words of kindness and generosity. They are, well, shall we say, they were perhaps the best medicine one could be provided, given the fact that yesterday was a particularly uncomfortable day. Now, today I am significantly better, but I am not completely well. And this time, definitely, this is going to be a shorter program than usual. I am still under strict orders to take things easy and to rest as much as possible. And my wife, of course, insists, and it's only wise that I should follow the advice, the medical advice that I have been given. Well, let me now turn to the events of the last 48, 36 hours, including the time that I have been away. And I would suggest that far and away, the most interesting event that has happened over the last 36 to 48 hours is the decision of the United Arab Emirates to quit OPEC and OPEC Plus. In other words, to forge out independently by itself as an oil producer outside the structures of the OPEC cartel, a cartel which the UAE joined in 1967. But I will say this, I think this is important and interesting for different reasons than the reasons we are seeing circulating in most of the media over the last 2 days or so. And most of the commentary in the media has been about the tensions between the UAE and Saudi Arabia, which do in fact exist. The fact that the UAE has been unhappy about the size of its OPEC production quotas, that the UAE would supposedly be happy with a lower price of oil, provided it could export more of it. Whereas Saudi Arabia, as the big oil exporter, but as a country with heavy liabilities which it needs to satisfy, prefers a higher price for its oil than the UAE supposedly is able to tolerate. And anyway, most of the discussions have centred on these sort of issues and over the issue of how the UAE somehow feels let down by the lack of support it feels it has been getting from Saudi Arabia, the de facto head of OPEC, and by the way, Russia, which is also a key member of OPEC Plus over the course of this conflict in the Middle East. I am going to suggest that there is probably another reason, though it is a reason which I accept so far does not find much confirmation in the published figures. And that is that I think this step taken by the UAE is a sign that with the Strait of Hormuz closed, the UAE is under a great deal more financial pressure than it wants to admit to. And we've had signs of this. Firstly, the UAE refused to roll over a $3.5 billion loan it made to Pakistan. And there was lots of discussions about why this was so. There were some suggestions that the UAE was unhappy about the fact that Pakistan was trying to mediate between Iran and the United States. For the UAE, supposedly, it is all a case of all or nothing, unless Pakistan sides fully with the Arab states, with the UAE and others, in treating Iran straightforwardly as an aggressor. Well, in that case, it's not good enough, and the UAE is unwilling to support and assist a country that, like Pakistan, that takes a middle road. It is, with them, apparently, all or nothing. Either you are for us or you are against us. And that was how the decision not to roll over the loan to Pakistan was explained. The other thing that has happened over the last few days has received minimal attention in the international media. The only journalist I've seen who has discussed it has been Wolfgang Munchau. And this was the fact that, as was revealed by the US Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent, the UAE and the Federal Reserve Board had entered into a currency swap arrangement whereby the United States would provide on demand dollars to the UAE in case they were requested urgently by the UAE. The UAE would send to the United States its own currency, dirhams, in return. And Wolfgang Munchau, the only Western journalist that I know who has discussed this question, was puzzled by the UAE's motives in taking this step. He, like everyone else, believes that the UAE is very rich, that it has very deep financial reserves. He was wondering why the UAE would need to take a step of this kind, and thought that there must be something wrong somewhere, that he couldn't quite decide what it was. And he said that he found this an ominous sign. And now we have this decision by the UAE to pull out of OPEC, which, it seems to me, suggests that if stability is returned to oil markets, or at least if oil can be freely traded again as a result of some form of reopening of the Strait of Hormuz, the UAE's intention is to sell oil in as great a quantity and at whatever a price it can. Now, I say the last, despite assurances that the UAE is making that it will still work to ensure stability in global energy markets. But if that really was the UAE's intention, I cannot myself see why it would take the big step of pulling out of OPEC and of OPEC Plus. Clearly, the UAE wants to sell oil at whatever price it can and at whatever volume it can manage. And to my mind, the only explanation for this is that at some level, in some way, the UAE's liabilities either exceed its assets or are closer to matching the size of its assets than the UAE authorities want to acknowledge. Now, I want to stress this is very speculative on my part. I have no actual information to confirm this. It is true that over the last year or so, the previously friendly relationship between MBS, the Crown Prince and de facto ruler of Saudi Arabia, and his former friend, the Crown Prince and of Abu Dhabi, who is also the de facto ruler of the UAE, that this relationship is frayed. And it's certainly true that the UAE has taken a much more hostile attitude to Iran over the recent conflict in the Persian Gulf than, say, the Saudis have done. But in a sense, the last is also an indication that the UAE cannot afford a prolonged closure of the Strait of Hormuz and in an interruption in the oil, its oil export trade, and that it is this which is making the UAE so hostile and so critical of Iran at this time, so much more hostile and critical of Iran than the other Arab states. And that probably explains, or possibly explains, the currency swap that the UAE worries that it might need dollars at some point over the next few months, which is why it's entered into this arrangement with the Federal Reserve. And perhaps, again, it is shortage of dollars or worries about shortage of dollars, which means that the UAE currently is unwilling to extend loans like the one it has made to Pakistan. What happened in the case of Pakistan is that it was bailed out by the other Arab states, first and foremost Saudi Arabia, which of course means that the UAE has now been repaid $3.5 billion, suggesting to me that it needs the cash. Now, to repeat again, this is speculation on my part, but I would suggest that this is far and away the most logical explanation of what is going on. Now, if this is correct, this has serious implications. And again, I want to stress if this is correct, because the UAE is today not just the Arab world's financial centre. It has become a global financial centre as well. Dubai in particular has positioned itself as a major financial centre in which much of the world invests its money. And, well, if the UAE is in trouble, then perhaps it is in trouble because its financial centres are in trouble. Perhaps there's some kind of feedback loop of which I myself am unaware, just saying. And if that in turn is true, then if a major financial centre is in trouble, that is going to have a wider impact on the situation in the global financial markets and potentially in the global economy. To repeat for a third time, this is all speculation on my part. It's speculation which I've noticed that no one else wants to make. It remains for me, though, as I said previously, the most logical explanation for all of these moves. I suspect that people are worried about talking about it because they're worried about thinking through its implications. Anyway, I don't want to say more. This is all I'm going to say about the subject up to now. I may be entirely wrong. The Emirati authorities can, of course, confirm that. Perhaps they should. Anyway, we will see what will happen. Now, with that, I'm going to skip further discussion of the situation in the Persian Gulf. The latest comments by President Trump suggest that he has indeed given up on ideas of conducting military strikes on Iran, that his intention, his plan now, is to tighten the blockade of Iran, which so far as I can see, certainly does need tightening. And well, in the meantime, Putin in St. Petersburg did meet with Araxi. The meeting in St. Petersburg went very much as I'd anticipated in the program I made on Monday. I noticed that Admiral Kostyakov, the head of Russian military intelligence, the organization that almost certainly is leading any Russian effort to provide military support to Iran, was in on the meeting, a fact which I noticed the Western media did not touch on. But in all other respects, in fact, in that respect too, the meeting between Putin and Araxi went very much as I have expected. Meanwhile, the markets seem to be finally acknowledging that this is going to be a long drawn out conflict. And I noticed that the oil price continues to rise. Well, all of that is very interesting, but perhaps even more interesting and even more pressing are the developments that are taking place in the other war, the war that is playing out in Ukraine, which, though perhaps not quite as well vivid at the present time as the conflict between the United States and Iran, retains in full measure its importance. Now, this, of course, is the war in Ukraine, which began in 2022 and which continues. And there have been, as it happens, further news about that war over the last 24 hours, news from the front lines. In Konstantinovka, the Russians claim to have captured, the Russian Defense Ministry says the Russians have captured a village called Ilinka, which is located immediately to the west of Konstantinovka. In truth, it really isn't a village at all. It is a suburb of Konstantinovka, but it's an important suburb because through control of it, the Russians have been able to sever another of the main supply roads in supplying the Ukrainian garrison in Konstantinovka. And on the northeast of Konstantinovka, there are reports that the Russians are close to capturing another village, again, more properly, a suburb of Konstantinovka, Dolgoya Balka. I think I've got the name correct. Now, I think it's fair to say, and I think most military commentators would concede, that if both of these villages fall, with the Russians in control of the industrial area in the centre of Konstantinovka and the high-rise building area in Konstantinovka, then the Ukrainian garrison in Konstantinovka will be caught in a vice, you could say a cauldron, and the battle of Konstantinovka will have been decided and will be approaching a rather brutal end, an end with another cauldron like the ones we saw last year in Pokrovsk and Mirnograd and Kupiansk. Now, by the way, on the topic of the Kupiansk cauldron, I mentioned in a program I made about a week ago that it looked as if the cauldron on the east bank of the Oskol River in eastern Kupiansk had finally collapsed, and that Zelensky had sacked the generals and commanders in charge, and that we had lots of information now that appeared to confirm the presence of the Russians in Kupiansk, throughout the town of Kupiansk, on the west bank of the Oskol River as well. Over the subsequent days, a number of really shocking photographs appeared of Ukrainian soldiers who had been in positions on the east bank of the Oskol River, precisely where the Russians were said to have established their cauldron. And these pictures, these photos, showed extreme emaciation on the part of these soldiers. I mean, they were really upsetting to look at. And I noticed that Zelensky and Sirsky pronounced that it was because of the mistreatment of these soldiers and the fact that these soldiers had been deprived of proper supplies, that those officers, the generals and the colonels in the Kupiansk area, had been sacked. I have to say that I found the whole thing disturbing and chilling, to say the least, because the truth, or so it seems to me, is obviously otherwise. The reason those soldiers became so emaciated was obviously because of what the Russians said had happened, that they were trapped on the east bank of the Oskol River in a Russian cauldron. Something which made it very difficult to send supplies to them through the long weeks and months of the Ukrainian autumn and winter. The proper, humane thing to do, and I would have thought the militarily wise thing for the Ukrainians to do, was to order these troops to withdraw from across the Oskol River. That never happened, and the reason that never happened was obviously because orders were given to these troops to remain where they were. And there is no mystery as to who gave those orders. Zelensky and Sirsky did, as they always do. And, of course, they gave those orders last autumn and insisted on maintaining them throughout the autumn and winter, because throughout this period they have been peddling the story of a successful Ukrainian counteroffensive in western Kupiansk, in the city of Kupiansk on the west bank of the Oskol River. So, as a result, those soldiers were marooned on the east bank of the Oskol River without proper supplies, and they became emaciated in the way that they did. When everything fell apart this spring and the troops had to be withdrawn from the east bank of the Oskol River, or more precisely, when the cauldron finally collapsed and it became impossible any longer to deny Russian control of western Kupiansk on the west bank of the Oskol River, well, we sack the generals and commanders and blame them for the emaciated condition of the soldiers, which Zelensky's and Sirsky's orders had brought about. If you want a single incident that encapsulates the realities of much of what has been going on in this war. Well, you have it here. And this is what, again, I'm going to say about it. Well, anyway, it looks as if another definite cauldron is now developing in Konstantinovka. And I'm going to say at once that I doubt that any lessons have been learnt. I doubt that anything has changed. I firmly expect that the Ukrainians will be ordered to hold their positions in Konstantinovka, no matter what, in order pointlessly to draw out the battle in that town for a few more weeks. Anyway, that's what I wanted to say. There's also been further news in other places. Today, this morning, the Russian Defense Ministry announced that two further villages had been captured, both with the same name. One is a place called Novodimitrovka in Donetsk region. I've no idea where this is. And another, a Novodimitrovka in Sumy region. Again, I don't know where this is. I have lost track with some of the movements on the battlefields because I fell ill on Monday, as you all know, and was ill yesterday. And I have not fully caught up on recent events. But let me reiterate again the point I have made, which is that despite denials, there is an ongoing Russian offensive in Donbass and across the contact line. Anybody who pays close attention to what is taking place can see it. It is progressing, in my opinion, faster than the Russian offensive progressed at this stage of the war in at the beginning of the offensive in April of last year. And we can see how things are shaping out. More places falling, the Ukrainians continuing to retreat. Now, this then brings me to the next important event of the last 24 hours. And it is an event at which Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia, is playing center stage, has taken center stage. Now, as I've discussed in many programs, basically since the Valdai incident, since the attack on Putin's residence in Valdai, at a time when the Americans and the Ukrainians both believed that he was in his Valdai residence. Anyway, since then, Putin has basically kept a very low profile. He's made very few statements about the course of the war. He said very little about Ukraine. He's had one meeting with Witkoff and Kushner, which doesn't seem to have gone well at all, by the way, just to say. That was at the end of January. And, well, there's been basically almost nothing else. It's been left to others, to Medvedev and Lavrov, first and foremost, and on the military side, on Gerasimov, to make the running and to give the statements. But yesterday, Putin finally reemerged. And he did so in connection to an event that has attracted a great deal of attention, partly because the Ukrainians have been keen that it should attract a lot of attention, which is the drone attack on the Black Sea port, the Russian Black Sea port of Tuapse, and the attack on various oil storage installations that are located there. Now, how much actual damage has been done to the facility itself, how long it would take to repair, is difficult to judge. Satellite photos have been produced, which some say suggest extensive damage. But then I cannot check satellite photos. My vision issues make that impossible. I've read reports in the Financial Times that published satellite photos nowadays are often affected by AI-produced distortion. Now, this is in relation to satellite photos made of targets that have been damaged in the Middle East, but I don't see why the same should not be true of targets damaged over the course of this conflict in Ukraine. So, if true, and as I said, we have the Financial Times telling us this, then that is a good reason to put a question mark over satellite photos in general, and to perhaps place a little less reliance upon them. And anyway, I can say, both from historical knowledge and from discussions, many discussions I've had over the years, since long before I started to make programs like this with engineers and people of that kind, including, by the way, since I might as well mention it, an engineer, a British engineer, who's of course deceased now, but who was very active as an engineer during the Second World War, and who was one of the engineers who worked on establishing the Mulberry Bridges that were used in D-Day. Anyway, on the basis of the information that all of these people have given me and my own historical reading and experience, I can say confidently that refineries and oil installations can be repaired very quickly, and that is true generally of industrial facilities as well. And what might superficially look as extensive damage actually is not necessarily so. But I'm not going to dwell on this, because over the last 24 hours, the Russians have decided to make a very big issue of the attack on the installations in Tuapse. Mostly, they avoid discussing Ukrainian attacks on drone attacks on facilities in Russia. But this time, they have decided to take a different approach. And there's been, we're told by the Kremlin, a report provided to Putin about the attack on Tuapse and the damage that was done. And there's also been comments from Peskov, Putin's spokesman, about the damage, the attacks on Tuapse. Peskov makes the obvious and entirely true point that the attack appears to be intended to interfere with Russia's oil exports, which at a time when there is a global energy shortage can only make the situation with the situation in the energy markets, the global energy markets, even worse. For the record, just before I made this program, the price of oil was currently trading at $15 a barrel. And that, of course, the market price, it's probably, in terms of the actual wholesale price of oil currently traded, much higher than that. But anyway, Peskov made this point. But anyway, the whole affair was, so far I could see, staged to prepare for this statement that Putin has just made. And it is a statement that he made when he had a discussion with various officials in the Kremlin. These were security officials mostly, but also, interestingly, others like the president of the Constitutional Court, Valery Zorkin, and the president of the Supreme Court, Igor Krasnov, and the other officials who mostly deal with civilian matters. Anyway, at this meeting in the Kremlin, Putin discussed election security questions. Now, here it is important to say that in the autumn there are going to be parliamentary elections in Russia. Elections to vote in a new Duma, a new parliament. And this meeting was convened in order to discuss tightening security in order to protect the conduct of those elections. But interestingly, over the course of this meeting, Putin focused not on potential internal threats or disruptions or interference from Western-backed NGOs, as has been the case in the past. He focused instead on the threat from Ukraine. And he said this: "The risk of terrorist threats are increasing. International terrorist organizations, as well as radical and extremist groups, continue their subversive activities. We know that both the Kiev authorities and their sponsors means the countries which support them in the West and their intelligence agencies, are resorting to openly terrorist methods. The reasons are clear and evident to everyone. The enemy is unable to stop the advance of our troops on the line of contact and continues to lose territory every day. Thus, they place stakes on acts of terror against both military personnel and civilians. These tactics are not going to change anything, but the threats remain and are growing. Drone strikes against civilian infrastructure are becoming more frequent. A recent example is the attack on energy facilities in Tuapse that could potentially cause grave environmental challenges." By the way, on that last point, I should say that I can remember that during the first war between the United States and Iraq in 1991, the Iraqi authorities, Saddam Hussein, were accused of releasing huge amounts of oil into the Persian Gulf, creating a severe environmental disaster. And there was lots of criticism at the time in the West, amongst Western governments, and about Western media over this brutal action supposedly taken by Saddam Hussein. And there was talk that this might be a war crime. Well, that might have been true. I'm not going to revisit that incident, but I noticed that this time, despite the fact that, as we will see in a moment, there is no doubt at all that this attack on the energy facilities in Tuapse is indeed having environmental consequences. Anyway, I've not seen any criticism in the West of this attack on those grounds whatsoever. Indeed, somewhat surprisingly, the Western media in general has avoided saying too much or very much about the attack on Tuapse. Anyway, Putin continues. "The governor has just reported He is there on the ground, or was there a couple of hours ago, adding that there don't seem to be major threats and the people are coping with the challenges they are facing. Security and counterterrorism measures are particularly critical in light of the upcoming election campaign. In September, Russian citizens will elect deputies of the State Duma of the Ninth Convocation, and large-scale regional and local elections will be held. Our priority is to ensure the safety and security of all participants, including candidates, election commission members, observers, and the tens of millions of citizens who will cast their votes. This is especially relevant for the Donetsk People's Republic, the Lugansk People's Republic, as well as Zaporozhye and Kherson regions, where residents are expected to vote in federal elections for the first time. Those who deny Donbass and Novorossiya their historical right to be part of their homeland, of Russia, will attempt to hinder them like they did before. Let me remind you that in Ukraine, elections are not held under the pretext of martial law, and now they're trying to hinder us too. However, strong and determined people, strong-willed people, dare I say, live in these regions, and they will not be intimidated. This has happened more than once, and so it will be now. The state must do everything necessary to ensure the free expression of will for all citizens across the Russian Federation. So this is what Putin said, and you can see that he is making great play of the issue of Tuapse, the attacks on Tuapse, to hammer home his point that this is a government in Kiev that shows no hesitation in resorting to terrorism, that the attacks on civilians and civilian infrastructure in Russia are terrorism, that it is the duty of the Russian state to provide protection, that the objective of the Ukrainians first and foremost is to disrupt the coming elections, that the Ukrainians are getting backing from their Western sponsors in prosecuting this terrorist campaign, and that the Russians, the people in Russia, need to be prepared for this. Now, in relation to the events in Tuapse, one thing that is certain about this attack is that whatever long-term damage was done to the facilities, it did cause a huge fire with enormous amounts of soot and smoke issuing from the facility and covering the port and the city and its environs. And it does appear as if the Russian authorities had to conduct large-scale evacuations of people, which of course is essential in these kind of environmental conditions. And that of course takes us back to Putin's point about this attack having environmental consequences, which is true. But, well, you could say that an attack of this kind, precisely because of the smoke and soot and the scale of the fire, made it impossible ultimately for the Russians, for the Russian authorities to ignore. Attacks on other facilities, which are pinpricks, can be treated as regional news to be dealt with by the local authorities, which has generally been the case up to now. As I've said many times, they are basically pinpricks rather than events that inflict real damage on the Russian economy. But this attack on a Black Sea port, at a time close to the holiday season is one which, because of the scale of the fire and the smoky clouds and all of that, simply could not be ignored. I will here express my opinion that this was well understood by the Ukrainians and is probably the reason, not just as to why they attacked Tuapse, but why they attacked Tuapse in the way that they did. Now, having said all of that, here we see Putin directly accusing Zelensky and his officials of involvement in terrorism, state terrorism. Now, this is not the first time that Putin has done this. He did this previously in connection with the Crocus Hall attack, and in relation to which, in connection with which, by the way, the perpetrators have now been tried and convicted and jailed, with reports from the Russian judicial and law enforcement authorities that they were indeed acting on instructions and on behalf of Ukraine. Anyway, Putin did that on that previous occasion, and he's done it on other occasions too. He did this, as I remember, at the time of the Ukrainian incursion, invasion of Kursk. He spoke then about the terroristic nature of certain of the things that the Ukrainians were doing then. And on both previous occasions, I did wonder whether Putin might be thinking of upgrading the seriousness, upgrading the current special military in operation, possibly into an anti-terrorist operation, which would, of course, increase the gravity of the crisis. It would upgrade it significantly and would open the way for the Russians to do certain things which up to now they have generally avoided doing, like making attacks on the key decision-making centres, such as, for example, targeting Zelensky and Syrsky and people like that themselves. Well, Putin didn't do it on those occasions. I believe that he was put under significant internal pressure to do it. I would not be surprised if he is coming under similar pressure again. Whether he will do so this time or not remains to be seen. But bear in mind what he's now saying, that the Russians must take steps to protect the entire population of Russia, which is going to be participating in the elections in the autumn, that these elections are going to cover not just pre-2014 Russia, but also all of the territories that Ukraine continues to insist are its own: Crimea, Donbass, Zaporozhye, Kherson, and that the Russians, that Putin says that it is the duty of the Russian authorities to protect them. Now that is a very, very tall order indeed, given the vast size of the country, given the fact that many of these attacks that the Ukrainians are now making are being carried out by drones. And why one does wonder what exactly he has in mind. Now, two thoughts immediately came to me, which is that Putin is talking about conducting elections in Donbass, in Donetsk and Lugansk, and also in Novorossiya, which of course means Zaporozhye and Kherson region. But note that not all of Donbass is in fact under Russian control. The regions of the Lugansk region has recently fully passed under Russian control, but there are still the important towns of Slavyansk, Kramatorsk, Druzhivka, Konstantinovka, Liman, and Dobropilya in Donetsk region, which are still controlled by the Ukrainians. Could it be, might it be, that Putin is giving a subtle instruction to the Russian military to complete what he would call the liberation of Donetsk region before the elections in the autumn? I don't think this is such a tall order, just saying. I think it might be within the realm of the possible, though it might require an acceleration of the Russian offensive. But then that is normally what happens over the course of Russian offensives. They gradually pick up momentum during the late spring, early summer, until they finally peak in the late summer and early autumn, when most of the ground that they capture is finally captured. Even then, I should say, if we say assume that the Russians will have taken control of all of Donbass by early autumn, before the elections, I still cannot see how elections could be organized in places like Slavyansk, Kramatorsk, and such places, given the time needed. But anyway, that is one thought that I admit I did have in mind, that Putin is, as I say, signaling either his desire for an acceleration of the offensive, or possibly has been given assurances that by the autumn, by the time of the elections, all of Donbass will be under Russian control. This is again, of course, speculation. I don't know what briefings Putin receives. I don't know what instructions he privately gives to the military. This is purely a guess. But the second is, given the enormous scope of trying to provide total protection for the entire population of Russia in the elections, is it possibly the case that Putin this time is indeed contemplating upgrading the special military operation? That the military and security officials, people like the head of the FSB, Bortnikov, for example, who participated in this meeting, that they will tell him that in order to do that, it's necessary to upgrade the special military operation to an anti-terrorist operation in order to simplify procedures and to improve reaction time on the part of the Russian security forces. And could that be the reason why all these judicial officials, Zorkin, the head of the Constitutional Court, Krasnov, the head of the Supreme Court, Gutsan, the prosecutor general, could that be the reason why they were all attending? Were they there perhaps to provide legal advice? Another person who was also present was Bastrykin, who is the head of the investigative committee, who, though a law enforcement officer, has a legal background, having historically previously worked within the Procurator General's office. Could it be, as I said, that the reason all of these people were present is because the legal details of upgrading the special military operation to an anti-terrorist operation were had to be discussed with all of them? Putin, as I never tire of pointing out, is a trained lawyer. He, by the way, has pointed this out himself. Moreover, he is not just a trained lawyer, but judging from the careful way in which he works, he's also a lawyer who has unquestionably, at some point in his career, been in legal practice. I am not sure when, I am not sure how. It is not there in any of his official biographies. My own guess is that he might have acquired this experience whilst he was still officially a member of the KGB. My guess is that he acted as a legal officer for the KGB, and that was his actual work in that organization. But again, I don't pretend that I really know. But anyway, Putin is always meticulous about these matters, even when he takes steps which appear to stretch the law to breaking point. He's always careful to give himself some degree of legal justification and also to ensure that the forms are observed. And I do wonder whether he isn't now soliciting advice about this. A lot advice from the Kremlin's own legal experts, but whether he's also seeking broader advice by calling in the leaders of the judiciary, the prosecutor's office, the procurator's office, and of course, Bastrykin, the head of the investigative committee. Anyway, I myself also believe that this meeting has to be taken into context, read in the context of all of these other very interesting recent statements that have been made by Russian officials like Medvedev and Lavrov and others, all suggesting that the Russians have hardened their stance significantly towards Ukraine over the last few weeks, specifically that they are no longer supportive of the idea of Ukraine joining the EU, though I would not be surprised if eventually further demands follow. Anyway, we shall see. We shall see what Putin does. Putin has often appeared to take us to the brink of implying that he's prepared to take some major step in connection with the Ukrainian conflict. As I said, I've twice before thought that he might be preparing to upgrade the special military operation. And, well, he didn't do it. But this time, I think we might be closer to that point. Certainly his words suggest this. And again, to repeat, all of this has happened in the context of all of the various comments and statements from other Russian officials, which we have heard. In the meantime, the West remains totally blind and deaf to the whole situation. There's been a dwindling of commentary in the Western media about Ukraine. Most of the commentary in the West is now, to the extent that it focuses on the situation in foreign affairs, it's been focusing, unsurprisingly, on the situation in the Middle East. Chancellor Merz of Germany has made an extraordinary statement saying that the United States has been humiliated by Iran. I have to say that I don't think he's actually wrong, but I do wonder about the wisdom of making a statement like that, one which is certain to infuriate President Trump. But it's not actually difficult to understand why Chancellor Merz made that statement. The latest opinion polls now show the AfD firmly in the lead, polling at 28%. It looks now a bankable certainty that the AfD is going to win big the regional election in Saxony-Anhalt in September, where it is leading with 40% of the vote. Chancellor Merz's party, the CDU, historically the dominant party in German and before that West German politics, going back all the way to the foundation of the German Federal Republic in the 1940s, it is currently polling at 24%. Chancellor Merz's popularity appears to be collapsing from being the 18th most popular politician in Germany, which is already pretty dismal. I believe he's now fallen to 30th, which is astonishing given that he is Chancellor. I should say that I have never in my long life of following the politics of Germany, and this I should say goes back to the 1970s. I've always been felt myself very close to Germany in this respect. I have never known such an incredible disjunction between the reputation of a German chancellor outside Germany and that same chancellor's reputation within Germany. In the past, German chancellors who have been respected internationally have commanded similar levels of respect and support internally. This was true of Willy Brandt, of Helmut Schmidt, of Helmut Kohl, of Gerhard Schröder, of Angela Merkel. All the chancellors whom I remember. In the case of Olaf Scholz, Merz's immediate predecessor, he lost support outside Germany in roughly the same way, and at the same time as support for him domestically inside Germany collapsed also. But if you read the media in much of Europe outside Germany and in the United States, you would come away sometimes with the impression that in Friedrich Merz, Germany has a towering statesman for its leader, the man who is leading Germany back to rearmament, who is charting a course for Germany's revival, who is positioning Germany to take the lead as the leader of the West during the difficult and dark years when the United States is led by Donald Trump. There's recently been an editorial in the Financial Times, for example, of all places, which talks about Germany and Friedrich Merz in exactly the same way. In Germany, now in the fourth year of its economic malaise or contraction since the start of the special military operation, with Merz's obdurate insistence of making the conflict with Russia the overriding priority of his chancellorship, and with everything else appearing to go wrong, it is far different. There, Merz's support is sinking. And, well, what I have heard, bear in mind I'm not in Germany, but I've heard that with some people in Germany, he's become not just a deeply disliked figure, but also is increasingly seen as in some way an absurd, even preposterous one. Anyway, there it is. It's not, as I said, difficult to understand why Merz, therefore, is trying to win back some support. He knows that the AfD is positioning itself as Germany's nationalist, sovereigntist party. Merz wants to steal that thunder. He knows that Donald Trump is unpopular. So this is a good moment to say unpleasant things about the United States and its leader. He is, without any conviction, floating possibilities of Ukraine trading territory for peace. Though I should say that the Ukrainians, Zelensky, will be certain to reject that. And I don't get the sense that Merz really has any sense of conviction in making that proposal. Overall, despite this rhetoric, Merz, who, to repeat, is the one European leader who has the authority and the power to carry out a successful change of course, he shows no sign of doing so, despite all of the internal pressures. He seems intent instead of continuing with Germany's current anti-Russian course until Germany basically falls off the cliff. And the same is true pretty much everywhere else. If we're talking about Britain, I'm going to express here my brief dismay at the speech that the British King, Charles III, gave to Congress yesterday. Firstly, to my mind, this speech was overtly political. It took positions on political matters, which I don't think in the British system the monarch should ever do. In fact, there is supposed to be a political convention to prevent it. I am not going to explore that question here. What I will say about this speech is that over the course of it, the King, Charles III, again reverted to the topic of Ukraine. He again demanded unrestrained support for Ukraine. He spoke about the importance of continuing Ukraine, and he urged unyielding resolve in the cause of Ukraine and her most courageous people in order to secure a truly just and lasting peace. Now, when British officials, and of course King Charles is in a sense the most senior British official of all, the Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, who's still Keir Starmer, as at the time of making of this programme, amazing though I find that fact. Anyway, the Prime Minister in the British system is, properly speaking, merely the King's First Minister. So when the King speaks like that, he's obviously speaking with the approval of the British Cabinet, and he's setting out British policy. And of course, when the British talk about a just and lasting peace in Ukraine, what they mean is the defeat of Russia and a Ukrainian victory, both totally unachievable things. There's been a further article in the Daily Telegraph pointing to the catastrophic effect state of the British Armed Forces. I won't repeat myself by discussing it, which shows that the British here are punching without any weight behind them at all, just saying. But anyway, that is what Charles does. And again, what he is doing is he is showing no change of policy or approach on the part of Britain at all. Here we see a steady drum roll of statements from the Russians showing that they are intent on taking, well, shall we say, an unflinching line on Ukraine, which is likely to become tougher. Note again Putin's words that these, as he calls them, terrorist attacks, these tactics are not going to make any change. The Russians are not going to be intimidated by them or deterred from doing that which they have set out to do. And, well, once the Russians achieve their objectives, which they will, what then? How does Britain, Germany, and all of the other European countries find their way back to a relationship with Russia? What is the way forward? The Russians, as I've discussed in recent programs, as Sergei Lavrov is pointing out, are already construing some of this messaging from Europe as a sign that, quoting Lavrov again, Europe has declared war on Russia. King Charles's words to the American Congress can only confirm that view. I sense that in Europe, and certainly in Britain, we are playing with forces now that we do not understand. I tremble for my country when I think of what that might mean, but there it is. Anyway, this is where I'm going to finish today's programme. As I said, somewhat shorter than usual, maybe not as short as I'd expected or than my medical people would like, but there's always a lot to say. And let me remind you again that you can find all our programmes on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble, X and Substack. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar by going to our shop, links under this video. Last but not least, please remember, if you've liked this video, to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.